Hey everyone, welcome to the Hash Rate Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning into the show. On today's episode, I am joined by repeat guest Christy Lee Minahan. You guys hit me up in the DMs and request to have Christy Lee on again so she can share her valuable insights on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency mining. Christy was gracious enough to oblige and join me for this recording. I hope you all enjoy the show. Please make sure that you take a moment, leave us a rating and review on your preferred listening platform. Before we get started now, we've got a word from our sponsor and then we are on to the episode with Christy Lee. Enjoy. Boost your mind's performance with Ledin, a suite of institutional-grade services that can help you manage and optimize your digital wealth. Ledin works with Genesis, the most established institution in digital assets, to offer its clients access to savings and credit products at industry-leading rates and with unprecedented transparency. Want to boost your mind's revenue? Link your mind's payouts to their Bitcoin savings account, which lets you earn 6.5% APY on your Bitcoin. Their USDC savings account also pays out 10% APY, and these rates will be held until December 31st, 2020. Need to invest in more equipment but don't want to give up the upside on your Bitcoin? You can get a Bitcoin-backed loan from Ledin to access the liquidity you need without having to sell your Bitcoins. Want to amplify the returns of your Bitcoin? Ledin's B2X loan service lets you double the amount of Bitcoin you own through a Bitcoin-backed loan. There's no surprise that many miners use their services, including Hashrate, as the founders were miners themselves when they built this platform. If you want to learn more about Ledin today and how they can help you, head to ledin.io. That's ledin.io. Hey everyone, welcome to the Hashrate Podcast. I am the Bitcoin Broski and I am pleased to welcome back a very special guest, good friend of mine, good friend of the show, Christy Lee Minahan, aka Oh Gotta Girl. Christy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Whit. Or wait, no, I can't use your real name on live stream. It's a secret, right?
So, no, I'm pretty doxxed at this point. I think I'm out there.
You mean Bitcoin Broski isn't your Batman name?
That would be really cool. I am kind of pissed at my parents. They didn't think of that in 19, you know, when I was born. Just give me that from the start. That would have been fantastic. Save me a lot of trouble. But you know. How have you been? We haven't talked in a while.
Exhausted. Just exhausted. There's a lot going on in both my life and professionally, but happy exhausted. So, and the mining space is, you know, as chaotic as I left it. So I'm glad to see that. I have been enjoying the DeFi party, and just enjoying the stupidity that comes with it. You know, sushi one day, yams the next.
I am enjoying me some sushi right now. For a while, that dip was lovely. I've said this to all of my friends and family that's been like, oh, what do I do? Like, I want to get involved in crypto. What should I do? I'm like, buy some Bitcoin, buy some ETH, and then buy whatever Sam Bankman-Fried touches. Like anything that he puts his name on, just buy a little bag. It's working out pretty well so far, but
yes,
sushi is going to end up being very interesting. One thing though, you said you left proof of work. You're never able to leave. We're a part of you now, Christy. You can't go anywhere.
Yeah, I'm learning that. Once you've started, you never get out. But no, it's you know, after a lot of the Prompal debacle, I just need to break. I was talking about this with a friend. I think I just got completely burned out by a lot of the drama and the nonsensical, you know, arguments people make. And, you know, I'm glad to see that it wasn't just all prog pow. I'm seeing the exact same arguments being made with Ethereum Classic and SHA-3. And it feels like people just need a, you know, an excuse to complain about something.
Well, you got it pretty hard too. Like of all of the people, you seem to be a target that was getting the brunt of it. And maybe calling you a target isn't the right phrase, but, or the right term, but you did. You got a lot of flack during the whole Prog Pal debate. I mean, ETH is, I don't want to call it a shit show because a lot of the DeFi stuff is, you know, centered around it, but they can never seem to really come to consensus on anything, which is why it appears that ETH 2.0 may never happen. What are your thoughts on that? If you have thoughts that you'd care to share,
ETH 2.0 will happen. It will happen.
2025.
I'm not sure on a timeline, but there's too many motivated parties to make it happen. You know, it's just going to be people think it's this holy mystical grail that will somehow allow, you know, Ethereum to scale. And people don't understand it's going to just be different phases. It will slowly be, you know, phases that improve the product and pull it away from proof of work and push it into the proof of staking and add other things such as sharding and just general performance tweaks. And people need to stop mystifying it and glorifying it and treating it like it's the only way that Ethereum will be, you know, a viable coin. DeFi has already made, you know, Ethereum one of the most viable financial platforms to date. So, I think that, you know, it will happen. It will happen. It's a very hard problem that a lot of people are trying to solve. And what needs to happen first is, you know, the main team that's spearheading it. So the F2.0 research team that's funded by the Ethereum Foundation needs to come out and say, look, here's our reference implementation. Like here's everything finished. Then the other client teams will start to adopt it. But we already have the nodes for staking. We already have some, you know, early alpha releases. So stuff is moving on that path.
So in that case, when 2.0 kicks off, what then with all of the mining infrastructure that's been put in place to mine ETH?
Well, it doesn't disappear, right? It's going to be a gentle phase out. You know, before DeFi really blew up, I would have said that it would have either been dumped or moved off to other applications. But now what I actually think is going to happen is it's going to be reinvested back into layer two solutions. So a lot of the zero knowledge proofs, ZK SNARKs, ZK STARKs, are going to need GPU compute for these, you know, for a lot of the multipliers, for a lot of the calculation and a lot of the processing on that. And so I think a new market is going to slowly form where some of the larger miners will be able to team up with groups like Starkware and process the zero knowledge proofs. And I think from that, you know, a lot of this GPU hardware will slowly start to survive.
Okay. So, but does that then open up an entirely new market, right? I mean, if now you're talking about layer two being able GPU being able to support layer two, that could apply to any of the layer ones that are out there that are not currently proof of work even.
True, it can. I think Ethereum though is going to be the main adopter. I think I read something in the news as well about Tether adopting zero knowledge proofs. So you might end up seeing like exchanges also adopting these layer two solutions just to help scale up or to help preserve a little bit more privacy. Yes, I think a new market is going to open up for GPUs. I don't think Bitcoin will adopt ZKPs anytime soon. I think this is really Ethereum and Zcash's thing. I think part of it has to do with, you know, the politics around it and sort of carving out your own identity. This was really something that was born of, you know, the privacy coins, and Ethereum's always been friendly to that. Bitcoin is forging its own path, will probably have its own specific implementation, or will adopt, you know, ZKPs when the time is right.
Yeah. What do you make of the current development that's going on with Bitcoin when it comes to, I mean, it seems like ETH is moving forward. A lot of the other projects are moving forward and there's a bit of stagnation on the Bitcoin side.
It's progressing. I think the thing is that when Ethereum makes an update, it gets blasted out to every social media channel. Crypto Twitter hears about it. You know, the whole world hears about it. When Bitcoin makes an update, not so much. It's sort of just on a few mailing lists. Maybe someone will post it to Reddit, but it's mostly kept self-contained with the developers. So there's continual fixes. There's continual updates. And there's a lot that is being planned, but their release cycle over in Bitcoin land is a lot slower as well. You know, Ethereum seems to have a new release every 2 to 3 months. Bitcoin, maybe we're lucky to get two major updates once a year. So
I think it's just capitalization. Are they just underfunded? I mean, is there more money that's going to the devs that are working on ETH and the other projects? And that's why there's more output.
There's definitely more developers and more companies producing on ETH, and therefore, you know, more money going into the protocol. But on Bitcoin side, you know, with Square Crypto and a few other funds starting to give grants to developers, there's definitely talent there. See, a lot of the work that needs to be done on Bitcoin is really on the, what I call the not fun stuff. You know, it's a lot on the back end. It's a lot on the scaling.
Sure.
It's not really features. It's not really further advancement.
Nothing that's going to pump the price.
Yes. It's boring work that actually needs to be done. Whereas if you go over into Ethland, you know, there's a lot of innovation on nodes and how nodes are going to be able to sync. Good friend of mine is working on a new version of Fast Sync, which is pretty exciting. There's advancements on, you know, how smart contracts and new parts of the Solidity language. So there's some more fun stuff, I would say, happening in Ethereum, and that just naturally attracts developers. And you have, what, 9 client teams working over there? So,
well, you know, Bitcoin, although, you know, maybe not the most pumpable of the coins that are out there right now, there's still a ton of news, right? Since we've last spoken, God, it was like 3 months ago, I think, last time you were on the show. It seems like forever. A ton has happened. A lot has happened in China with regards to the hardware manufacturing side of things. I know you've always had your finger on the pulse with regards to new ASICs that are coming out. By the way, well, since I mentioned that, you had tweeted something out, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
About a new ASIC.
Which one? Oh, no. I'm not talking about that. No.
Okay. Damn it. No. All right.
They wanted me to talk about it on the drinking game as well. No. No.
Okay. I thought you were maybe talking about the Strong U ASIC when you'd alluded to it the first time.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Uh-huh. That was good. Nice job.
That's what I've been waiting for my whole life for, Strong U to come to the market.
I thought so. I thought that was my natural instinct, because like they launched the Dash ASIC, and you must have known that the SHA-256 ASIC was coming. And then, oddly enough, earlier today, I heard your name tied to an immersion ASIC solution, like a comprehensive immersion unit for Bitcoin mining.
How? Why?
I don't admit, I don't know. It's funny the conversations that you find, like I find myself in, that you get brought into.
I'm just everywhere, apparently, man. You know?
Are doing everything. It's kind of interesting. You're a woman of talents, Christy.
I must be like sleep mining or sleep developing. That's what's going on. No wonder I'm not sleeping well.
Right? You have earned this exhaustion that you currently are dealing with. So, but what are you making of this landscape? I mean, the current ASIC landscape as it is now, all the shit that's going on at Bitmain. I mean, do you have any insight? Or do you think
the first thing is most of the ASICs you're seeing, they're white labels. So, you know, the Strong U ASICs are just, you know, InnoSilicon, but rebranded because InnoSilicon's reputation was not the best in, you know, foreign markets. Mm. So most of these chips you're finding, you know, they're just rebranded. SBI Crypto is trying to do their own thing, and that's great. But what they'll end up hitting is probably just what Bitmain's already achieved. And I know they're going to hate me for saying that, but it's just a reality. There's only so much optimization you can get out of 7 nanometer. There is a ceiling on every process node.
But now to that end, though, just to jump in, to that end, if they hit what Bitmain's already achieved, I mean, that's okay. That's still going to
land
them
that's great.
Pretty good results, right?
That's great. And then it's going to become, you know, a competition of who can get the most wafer allocation. And that is, you know, that is the difficult part. Now, what ends up happening with allocation is while they're still taking from the same pool, you know, the North American silicon team, so like TSMC's North American division, has a separate amount of chips that they have to sell versus the China division. And so this will be actually quite good because SBI Crypto can just draw from that North American pool rather than dipping in and fighting Bitmain on the China allocation. So, you know, there won't be too much competition on that front. The stuff that, you know, Layer 1 is doing, that's just whatever chips they can get on the market, and they're just customizing it for immersion. there's going to be a lot more of these copycats. MicroBT and Bitmain are still going to be really leading out the charge on that front. Canaan's still playing catch up. I've alluded to, there are going to be bigger players, but I think in the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to see your Fortune 50 in America come into mining in a big way, because Bitcoin has now reached the scale where it can't really be ignored. It's become a critical part of a lot of North American, a lot of the North American companies, Fidelity's mining arm. You've got the Bitcoin bank that's started up. You've got BCG. There is now actually a market to go out and sell to some of these institutions, and the bigger companies are starting to see it.
But then, I mean, it just seems like the timing is off here, right? Like we need some solutions sooner rather than later.
Solutions for what? We already have Bitmain's machines.
With the delays and everything, I mean, aren't there plenty of people that would like to deploy faster? I mean, if a new player was to come to the market sooner, like, wasn't there?
Sure. But the delays, so here's the thing. There's two kinds of delays, right? There's the Bitmain delays, which are due to some internal issues with Bitmain. But then you've also got the general silicon delays. And this is, COVID set everyone back a few months. And allocation primarily went to the companies that would need it most, your GPU companies, your CPU companies, folks that are producing mobiles and gaming consoles and components. Bitmain still has, a giant chunk. So they're actually set on silicon. It's all of the other stuff that they have to go find vendors for. It's your little low value components, like your transistors and your capacitors, stuff that we really take for granted, but it can set back a whole deployment. But they've actually been, like, from my point of view, they've actually been quite on time with their deliveries. You've had like a 2 to 3 month delay. That's pretty tolerable. Now Canaan is pushing to meet, to meet the demand. But MicroBT is also pushing. But I think that there is real risk of overproduction. So I think this is what everyone's sort of tempering themselves for. The manufacturers don't want to overproduce like they did in the 2017 era. That was just stupid, because then you had a ton of equipment that flooded the market in 2018 and 2019. And then absolutely no one wanted to buy the newer generation machines for a while, which really hurt companies. So I think everyone's a little wiser now. There's going to be more controlled release cycles. It's not just going to be, hey, let's have a ton of miners just sitting floating in the ecosystem.
Interesting.
Folks are like, your institutions still have access to miners. Yes, I know the average, the average Joe doesn't.
But doesn't, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
That ends up happening, right?
Yeah. Is there hoarding that's going on right now? Are you seeing people or hearing of people that are just buying the machines to sit on them now and wait?
Not necessarily sit on them, but buy them just to have the largest amount of machines. Yes. Yes. You keep seeing people that are just like, they're making deals with these financiers to just buy as much equipment as they can. And then, they'll probably flip them for a profit.
Yeah. Fastest way to ROI your machine, right? Wow.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. Obviously there's a lot of facilities that are springing up in North America and the demand for the machines is growing. Is there a timeline for SBI? Have you heard like when they're planning on releasing a first iteration of their ASIC? Are you able to share that? Do you know?
No, man. They hate my guts. You'd know better than I do. Honestly, I don't think Carson likes me very much. I think he's buddies with our good friend Alex.
Gotcha.
But no, like honestly, I adore SBI. I think what SBI Crypto is trying to do, I just think that their pursuit of an ASIC was incredibly stupid. I think that what needs to be done is, if people really, really want to go produce their own ASICs, the smart route is to first go and just get a bunch of chips from probably InnoSilicon or probably Canaan. They are both friendly to just selling raw chips. Innovate on the PCB layer, so build up some IP there. Innovate on the casing, build up some IP there. Build up your own PSUs, innovate there. Then you've got three layers of IP that are unique to your operation. Because getting a competitive chip that, you know, beats out Bitmain is or, you know, is on par with Bitmain is going to be a very laborious event. And it has nothing to do with talent. It's all just about raw amount of time. You know, there's only so much time in the world. And this gives you a way to still get an edge over the competition while, you know, and have some unique selling proposition without wasting too much capital, without wasting too much time.
So now when you talk about getting chips, the story came out, and I don't know if it was a story or just a tweet thread from Colin Wu of Wu Blockchain about McCree having 5-nanometer chips and getting some pushback. What are your thoughts? I mean, does this matter? Is this a non-starter?
I mean, I tweeted out very, very frankly, like don't buy 5-nanometer chips. So 5-nanometer right now is at 80% yield. Those are our latest, you know, results from TSMC. And they're going to be available Q1 2021. Great. In general, buying the first run of any 7 or 5-nanometer capacity is, sorry, any process node capacity is not a good idea. Generally, you're going to have a lot of faults. The node hasn't matured. We haven't worked out all the kinks. There is a lot that goes on chemically with silicon in the background. And, you know, there's a lot that has to be figured out that can only be figured out by doing more runs. And so, you know, your first, I would say your first 2 to 3 runs of 5-nanometer for a company are going to be sort of experiments. And, you know, the story goes that McCree is pushing this because right now he can't get 7-nanometer or 16-nanometer capacity. Now that I believe, but I also think it's incredibly risky, and I don't think it's smart to be pushing off 5-nanometer to customers because you're going to end up tarnishing the Bitmain name, tarnishing, you know, your position in the market. So you'll end up having
like they're bulletproof. I mean, at this point, can they do wrong? Really? I mean,
I think it's just a lot of pride, and we see this all the time when companies have fallouts with the founders. Mm-hmm. You know, they go their separate ways, and there's just a lot of fighting, and it manifests in ugly, ugly ways. We've seen this with Oh man, what was that fellow up in New York? CoinMint.
CoinMint, yeah.
Yeah, we've seen the falling out with, you know, the two founders there, and the ugly stuff that's come out in the courts. It's just a natural progression. This usually happens when friends get into business together. You know, eventually it crumbles somewhere down the line. It can work. It's just very rarely do I see it work. Right. And I think McCree and Jihan have just had, you know, a falling out. It's going to manifest in more ugly ways. And right now there's going to be this fight for power because neither wants to let go. The smart thing to do would be, you know, Jihan goes to Matrixport and really just goes his separate way and claims ownership of that. And Jihan, you know, runs out Bitmain. Or Jihan takes over ownership of, you know, the entirety of the crypto stuff. And McCree goes his own way with the AI stuff. But yeah.
I mean, it's such a massive company. You'd hate to see it fall apart or crumble or lose such, you know, such market share because of infighting like this.
The mutually assured destruction. The shareholders won't let it fall through. I think people forget that Sequoia Capital backs Bitmain. You know, shareholders aren't going to let Bitmain fall through entirely. The biggest, you know, the biggest monster they have right now is social media and all of the stuff that leaks. Whether it's true or not, the entire world eats it up as fact. And so that's their biggest issue right now. They have a PR problem that they need to solve. And, you know, they have a information leakage issue that they need to solve.
I think they have an armies invading the office issue that they need to. I got to say, at least those videos have been fun to watch. I mean, you know, it's kind of like watching a a train wreck, but hopefully it all works out. You know, all the best to them.
Honestly, I hope that. So the other thing we have to remember is companies always push for the latest process node. So AMD, you know, wanted to get out 7 nanometer as soon as possible so they could claim they had the world's first 7 nanometer GPU. It's bragging rights for a company. And so I have no doubt Bitmain's going to go and push for 5 nanometer just so they can say, you know, we have the world's best 5 nanometer chip. But what will end up happening is you'll have a device that may have electrical faults, it may short, it may overheat, or it may, you know, it may have incredibly high leakage tolerance, meaning you have to pump more electricity through it to get it to function stably. And, you know, the yield isn't going to be great. So the cost of these devices is going to be more expensive. You're going to hit, so the first run is going to sit roughly at, by my estimates, probably 27 joules per terahash to, you know, 31 joules per terahash. So it's not really better than what we already have on the market. So.
But I mean, okay, so in this case, why are they announcing it that McCree is the one doing this and not Bitmain, right? Is this a move by McCree to just break off entirely from the company and do his own thing?
Probably to basically say, hey, we have the latest and greatest tech. I'm not sure McCree's going to be the only one announcing this. I'm sure Bitmain's going to, you know, announce 5 nanometer. Maybe all of the silicon engineers, you know, walked away with McCree. We don't really know. Sure. I do know that, you know, within Bitmain, there are people that are very loyal and passionate about McCree's vision. And there are people that are loyal and passionate to Jihan. And, you know, it's just going to be, there's going to be a split. And the correct way to do this would just be to have two sister companies that are under the Bitmain umbrella. But we won't see that happen anytime soon. And I do hope MicroBT steps up in the place of Bitmain and really grows to be able to serve all that capacity and demand.
I mean, right now it's just production capabilities for them, right? They can't meet the demands. I mean, if they could fill more orders, they would be gouging this market share right now.
My advice would always be to go sell, you know, the technology to say an Intel or do a joint marketing and joint partnership with either Intel or GlobalFoundries, because while the process node at GlobalFoundries isn't the best, you get access to the Mubadala Foundation, which will allow you to push all of your chips through the UAE, push your chips at a greater scale, and then you have a ton of production capacity there. Yes, it's not the best process node, but you do get a lot of scale and a lot of volume. So that's sort of the trade-off. Because TSMC right now is very overcrowded. It's not just Bitmain, right? It's TSMC serves the entire world for a lot of the silicon demand. And this is a security risk. I mean, Philip Salter from Genesis Mining has talked about this. Others have.
Yeah.
About how much of a concern it is that we've only got 4 silicon manufacturers. That being said, you know, a fab doesn't make money for the first 10 years of its life. So you're not going to see a lot of fabs just spawn randomly.
Spring up, yeah.
It's too expensive, and it's like you don't ROI on it. You've got to have investors that are really comfortable with their capital being locked up for 40 to 50 years before they start to see payouts. So yeah, of course there. And what ends up happening, by the way, is TSMC just acquires more foundries. Like if you build a foundry, TSMC is just going to acquire you. So yeah.
There you go. There's your exit strategy, everyone. Start a foundry. $100 million, and you can work for 10 years to get bought out by TSMC.
There you go. Join the TSMC umbrella. So yeah, it's a bit of a concern, of course, but you know, at the end of the day, if you look at hardware manufacturing as a whole, people freak out about how few manufacturers there are for things like phones and for things like, you know, a lot of our low value components that we were talking about, and for silicon. But this is hardware in general. There are not that many players out in the world. Mm-hmm. What there is a ton of is people white labeling things. So there's a ton of like middlemen and brokers, but yeah, there's not a lot of innovation and manufacturing going on. Sorry, let me rephrase. Not as much as people think there is. So like all of your servers really come from three locations in China, and then they're just white labeled up the chain.
So now as you're looking at all of this, the supply chain, everything that's going on with Bitcoin and mining specifically, is there any part of it that you're looking at that you're really excited for what's going to happen in that arena in the next 6 to 18 months?
I think the innovation that I'm seeing happening on the PSU side is really exciting to me. And also the innovation that I'm seeing happening right now in the chases. So why I'm excited about these two things is they can be applied to computing in general. And I think that the ASIC form factor is probably one of the most efficient form factors for computing in general. I think we're going to see a variation of that really get pushed out into alternate markets. And that's what's exciting to me.
Okay. A lot of people have been talking about the crossover between high-performance computing and Bitcoin, or I should say Bitcoin and high-performance compute. You've been very vocal about saying that they're not the same thing.
Yeah, Bitcoin mining is not high-performance computing. Please stop saying that. I dare someone to go to a HPC conference and give a presentation on Bitcoin mining. I dare someone. It's fraudulent to say that it is. Mining is very much in a field of its own. Yes, it's a difficult thing. Yes, it requires, it requires expertise, but HPC is really for scientific applications. I think someone glanced over the Wikipedia article, saw there was a mention of ASICs, and that any form of ASIC strung together to do one thing can be classified as HPC, and they've just run with it. And unfortunately, the way the world works and the way definitions and language work is it's the most commonly used definition that takes, hold.
Sure.
And so the scientific community really defines what is HPC and what is not, not us Bitcoin miners. So.
But what about, look, if I point my GPUs at folding at home, well, now it's high performance compute, right?
Totally, except folding at home doesn't know what to do with all of this GPU compute that's floating around the world.
there are clear applications, right? There are ways that you can look at Bitcoin mining and say, okay, this could also work in, did you call them ultimate markets? Did I hear you say that correctly? Or did you say alternate markets? I kind of like the ultimate markets thing better. No, but there are, right? Like there are aspects of Bitcoin mining that could certainly carry over to the compute world. And I know you've delved into both and had experience in both. Do you think that, okay, let me take a step back from this. As you're looking at Bitcoin mining, where do you feel that there could most immediately be an impact on the compute world?
Honestly, just in a lot of the tooling and managing this infrastructure at scale. In a lot of the density. So we do have a density issue right now in HPC. It's very hard to cram a ton of servers into one location. Generally, we're going for, a lot of spread and a lot of depth. And, all of the innovation Bitcoin has really made in terms of power consumption. So in green and clean energy, a lot of that can be brought back to the HPC world. I'm really passionate and excited about what Crusoe is doing, Crusoe Energy, with their oil and gas flaring. Passionate about what Upstream Data is doing. I'm still not confident that, natural gas can be used safely for HPC, but I do think there is a way that it can take off some of the load. And that would be fantastic. And I think HPC, the HPC world has a lot to learn from miners in general. Miners are incredibly scrappy. We nickel and dime every single component. We go for whatever will work rather than whatever is, whatever will future-proof us. We're constantly ensuring that we have 100% utilization of all parts of our rigs, something that the HPC world does not do. So there is a lot of waste over there. You have a lot of wasted cycles, a lot of idle time. while your GPUs might be at 100% utilization, you're probably not using your CPU to the fullest. So I think we do have, you know, things we can learn from that regard, but it's more philosophical things, right? It's not really some specific part of the Bitcoin stack that you can point to and say, yes, this is what I need right here.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I mean, that what you're saying, the sentiment echoes what JP Barrick had said on a previous podcast about just the density of compute and how right now that's where he thinks the biggest impact could be. Obviously, he's built a lot of facilities going and building the high performance compute centers, the data centers there, similar to how they're building mining data centers, would save a tremendous amount of cost. I just don't know. For me, it seems to be a tough sell when you talk about the people who are building data centers right now and how they have their methods of doing it. I don't know. Anything can change, right? But do you see there being more small / independent data centers popping up to support the additional demand that's going to come, or do you think it's all going to stay with these behemoths who are set in their ways?
Bitcoin or
compute,
HPC?
Compute. Yeah.
I don't think so. Here's the biggest issue. Data centers are a sunk cost, very much like foundries. Mm-hmm. You know, they only start making money if you have quite a lot of clients.
Yes.
And it only makes sense at scale. So that's the only way you can get the best power rates. And so the issue with these utility-like companies is that, at some point, once you reach a certain scale, it just becomes a pricing war. And it just favors the behemoths. And so I think what ends up happening is you do just have larger behemoths that serve everyone, and they fit into certain niches. And eventually, you know, the mining behemoths are going to be acquired by an Equinix or a Digital Realty or someone who really does specialize in data centers. It's just the way the world works. We naturally Sure. move towards centralization as much as we try to fight it. It just makes economic sense for quite a lot of people.
Clearly. That's, you know.
What I do think we will start to see, I'm seeing this trend actually in edge computing right now. I'm seeing containers. So just to set the tone, the idea of these computing containers did not come from Bitcoin. Huawei actually had this, you know, was advertising this in China in 2013. It was the data center in a container. And the idea was that, people that needed servers on site could take one of their containers and just drop it. So you could drop it on like the top floor of your mall, or you could drop it, you know, outside of your company's office to mm-hmm. get access to supercomputing capabilities. And so that was someone in China said, you know what, this is a really, really good idea. What if we did this for Bitcoin mining? Took the idea, reverse engineered Huawei's container. There were numerous iterations until 2016 when something sort of stable came out. And then Bitmain copied that and made their Antbox. And then this has continued. Now, what I've started to see is actually people dropping these containers right at the point of satellites for satellite providers and phone companies. We're starting to see a big push into federated learning as well. So federated learning is really about taking some sort of algorithm and training it across a bunch of low-value devices. Think Silicon Valley and, you know, mm-hmm. Pied Piper on a bunch of mobile phones. That's yeah. kind of federated learning.
Okay.
We're seeing, you know, a big push of these servers being dropped at the point of compute. And, you know, this is something where Bitcoin has really innovated quite a bit. We've been able to build containers really cheaply out of, you know, really scrappy materials, very power efficient. And I think that the traditional computing world is going to start borrowing from that and incorporating some elements. And then you're going to see a lot of independent providers in a way. They're not quite data centers, but, you know, there's just going to be a lot of these containers floating around. And it is more efficient. As long as you have access to power and internet, you know, why wouldn't you go for the modular data center versus a traditional, you know, giant brownfield where you Sure. have to have your equipment in a rack and you can't really move it.
Well, I mean, in that case, it seems like it almost just would become a part of construction expense for some of these companies, right? When you're planning your own build, you just include the mobile data center into your build out of, yep. of whatever structure. So, yep. I mean, clearly there's a lot of demand for that, especially if you're talking about all the universities and hospitals and I mean, so many places that would be,
yeah.
you know, call them super users, right? Who are going to use additional compute and could use a mobile solution like that.
I mean, hospitals and unis don't. So the reason you go for the mobile form factor is for latency. So anything that needs, you know, really low latency, that's more suited to a mobile application or a satellite application. Not so much universities and healthcare. So they're not, healthcare isn't training, you know, these incredibly complex algorithms that are dependent on, you know, low latency.
But what about robotic surgery?
Yeah, you go talk to any surgeon here in the US and see what they really think about robotic surgery. It's easily 5 to 6 years out. There's some experiments that are happening, but what you'll end up finding is most of the training has already been done. So it's not really AI. You don't really need compute. All of the brains is really housed in the robot itself. And then it's just pinging back to a server. And then it's just your network bandwidth, right?
Gotcha.
So compute is really, it's really important when you need to do a split of training and inference. And this is best suited to, you know, actually Netflix would be a perfect candidate as well. So when you're producing a movie or a series, you have your quick and dirty cuts that you usually need to send out daily, right? And right now it's an incredible headache for the movie industry. You're sending this, you know, over the American internet, which is not that great. And so instead, you know, what they would be able to do is render really quickly on site and then send a bit of a compressed but polished version back to HQ to review. So that would also be a great use case. But anywhere you need, you know, really bursty processing power. And then universities, honestly, don't use that much compute. You would think they do, but their needs are well served by Azure and Google. They do not have the budget for on-site compute. They do not have the desire to move away from the big three or from the FANGs, because then they get, you know, all of the benefits.
Sure.
All of the extra benefits. So.
God, if unis don't have the budget, nobody does.
Yes.
Well, I mean, look, the one thing is clear. It's an exciting time when it comes to all things compute and Bitcoin mining. There's a lot of headway that's being made. And yes, there's always going to be hiccups on the path. But, you know, Christy, it's always good to have you on the show because you know a lot, right? There's no doubt about it. You've been in the space almost as long as anybody. And you've really had a lot of crossover experience in many different worlds. So I always enjoy getting to chat with you and bringing you on the show to share what you know with all of us plebs. But thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for letting me rant. I enjoy ranting.
All right. And to the listeners of the Hashrate podcast and viewers on YouTube, thank you guys for tuning into the show. We have a ton more content that's coming your way. Make sure that you are subscribed to the YouTube channel and turn on notifications so you are always made aware when we put out new content. And of course, if you're listening on your preferred podcast platform, leave us a rating and review. We appreciate it very much. So for me and for Christy here at Hashrate Podcast, talk to you guys all again very soon. Thanks for tuning into the Hashrate Podcast. We appreciate your continued support. Please do us a favor and leave us a rating and review on your preferred listening platform. And head over to Twitter and give us a follow at Hashrate. That's at H4SHR8.